Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 198 for May 31st of 2013. Automotive telematics for the masses. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Mr. DeLorenzo.
Mr. McElroy, how are you?
I'm doing good. And boy, you got a milestone here with your website going.
Yeah, just...
You told me 15 years of Auto Extreme.
Well, going into the 15th year, just celebrated 14th year anniversary.
It seems like yesterday you started that thing.
Yeah. Except I can feel every minute of it, I think.
And we got Gary Vasilash with us tonight, too.
John, how are you?
I'm doing good, Gary.
Peter? Yeah. So what was your original pseudonym? Or was it just no name?
No, there was a name. Michael Paratori was the name that was on the site for the first 115 days.
Because you did not use your own name.
I was still at Campbell Ewald, my ad agency.
Because that way you could say whatever you wanted. And now that you've come out, so to speak, you're still saying whatever the hell
you
want.
I mean, it was funny when I started it. It was the original idea was for a car magazine, and I had the idea in '86 and was going to be a car magazine for enthusiasts that accepted no advertising, because we would say whatever we wanted to say, drive whatever we wanted to do, do bad things, make bad decisions with automobiles. And of course, you know, I was in the middle of my ad career, and I couldn't envision getting the funding. But come spring of 99, we just decided, hey, you know, we could do a website. And it was interesting. The early days were interesting. I came across a media list from GM PR. I don't even recall how. Well, I kind of recall how, but we used it to send email bursts the day we came out on that June 1st. And it was great because no one knew who I was. So when I did put my name on the site, which was 21st of September of 99, you know, I heard from all these people, I should have known it was you. And then there was a few of them said, wow, you should have just stayed the way it was.
People love a mystery.
Yeah, but I couldn't have kept it up. I was about to.
You would have been outed one way or another.
Yeah, I was about to get outed, so I.
Well, were people actively searching for your alter ego or your real identity
There was no way they could find it. The origin, if they went back to find the origin of the website, you know, the register, it was all concealed. So. Hmm.
Well, you started something. We're going to try something here on Autoline too. I should let everybody know. We're going to do. Let people see a behind-the-scenes taping of our television show. We're calling it, this is just a test, not of the emergency broadcast system, but we're calling it the Autoline Premium Test Drive. Tomorrow Friday at 1:15, we'll be broadcasting a show all about how Audi is changing its customer service experience at its dealerships. We're going to have an Audi executive, an Audi dealer, and an outside expert analyst on all of this. And we're going to charge for it. This is, like I said, a test. We're only going to charge 99 cents, kind of like how Apple does with music. But check it out on our website, autoline.tv. Again, that's tomorrow at 1:15 Eastern. And if you really want to check out anybody who competes against Audi, by the way, for all of you marketing people out there at other car companies, you may want to get an inside look at what's going on there. But anyway, that's something that we're playing around with.
That's cool.
So the media landscape keeps changing.
Doesn't it ever? And it's going to change a whole lot more, too, I'm sure. Just can do more and more on the web these days.
Changes by the minute.
Well, changes in the auto industry, too. What do you guys make of Better Place going belly up?
Well, they've clearly gone to a better place. would you miss it? I wouldn't. I mean, they burned through almost $1 billion.
Of other people's money. It wasn't
money.
Government money.
No, of other people's money.
You know, I had the opportunity to interview Shai Agassi, who
started
founder of the company. And, you know, this is a guy who had a great pedigree in terms of technology and software. And he also had what I believe some people refer to as Steve Jobs had this reality distortion field, that you'd get into his space and suddenly things seemed all different. And, I mean, you would talk to Agassi, and, I mean, it was mesmerizing how he just wanted to make you believe that this was the right way to do it, changing batteries, and this was going to be the future, and everything was going to change. And you just sit there and just like, yes, yes.
Yes, master.
Yeah, you know, I mean, then you'd like go 8 feet away, gone. Yeah. You know, it was that sort of thing. But I mean, conceivably, I mean, if you think about it for a minute, okay, so we all own flashlights, right? And we all know what D cells and C cells and AA cell batteries are, okay? And so it doesn't matter what flashlight we buy. We can buy Eveready's, or we can buy Costco, or we can buy Duracell and pop the things in, mix them up, doesn't matter, right? And it works, more or less, right? And I think that was sort of the idea, but you know, if you look at how EVs are designed in large part, the battery's part of the structure. The battery is you know, a different chemistry. The battery has got all kinds of implications that, you know, our flashlights just don't have. But somehow, you know, that didn't play into the way he was doing his calculations. And I think that, you know, the fact that Renault was very supportive of what they were doing and saying, okay, we'll design our batteries and they'll fit in. Well, that's fine. But, you know, again, if you're talking to General Motors, or you're talking to Ford, or you're talking to Mercedes, or you're talking to Toyota, I mean, they're not all going to say, yeah, we think that you have the right, you know, architecture.
We think a supplier has the solution for all of us. Right, yeah, that's not going to happen.
It's not going to happen for anything. You know what I mean?
You know, the Chinese did a very interesting, because they were very interested in this, too, because they want to leapfrog everybody and get into EVs. But they did an in-depth study, and I can't remember who did it over in China, but they came out and said, this doesn't make any sense, because each and every one of these stations has to have a minimum of 2 battery packs for every car that's going to come in. You know, just in case one's something not fully, we got to have 2. Well, what's the most expensive part of an electric car? The batteries. So you literally had to have $30,000 in investment in 2 battery packs for every car that was going to come in. And they said, if you try to scale this up across China, we just can't afford it. It doesn't make any sense at all. So in addition to no other car company other than Renault saying, yeah, we'll design our car to swap batteries,
right,
you had this other insurmountable upfront cost for all these stations. So,
yeah, they had a when they opened their first swap station that was like a big public thing. It was in Tokyo, and it was for a cab company. And so I sent one of my guys over there, and you know, and sure, it's cool if everything is designed the way it's supposed to be, and everything goes just right, and you only need 1 battery, not 2. And you know, but you know, I think that. You know, if we really think about the auto industry historically, right, and you look at the number of companies that have come and gone, I mean, especially in the early part, you know, the first half century, my God, I mean, there were such a vast number.
Hundreds.
And we sort of have the sense now that, you know, stable, this is it, you know, nobody's going to fail. Things, you know, you're going to make it, or you're irrelevant, and I think maybe it's just a natural growing process as these new technologies begin to emerge, and we'll probably see more of that. I mean, with Fisker, who knows what's going to happen.
What about fuel cells? You see fuel cells ever catching on?
Well, according to that study that Navigant Research did, what was it? It was just like,
yeah, they said by 2030.
2030,
right?
It was like 2 million?
2 million fuel cell cars.
Yeah,
right?
Despite the fact that they even pointed out that in 2011 and 2012, 500 were shipped.
And so somehow we're going to scale to that number that quickly. Right. I mean,
plus the hydrogen fueling infrastructure.
Right. And I mean, it's just like, how is that going to happen? And I just happened to be, I was bumping around looking at stuff in Sandia National Labs, which, of course, you know, are doing all kinds of things that are non-automotive, unless we have atomic-powered cars, I guess. You know, they just opened up a database that they had related to hydrogen and its effects on metals and different kinds of metals, because hydrogen has this way of just sort of wending its way into metallic structures, and then they become nice and brittle. And you think about, oh yeah, we'll have these pipes in the ground, or we'll have these giant hydrogen tanks in the ground, and or we'll ship it in vehicles, you know, that are made out of metal, right? And not so good. And so they just opened that up this week. That they were saying, you know, you can go online and, you know, check out your chemistry set. So
yeah. I'm gonna have to check that out, because yeah, that doesn't sound too good for fuel cells then.
No, so. But yeah, but 500, 2 million.
Yeah.
I haven't seen, you know, there's been advances in fuel cells, certainly, that, you know, Honda, quote unquote, sells them.
Well, they could have done it if they had bought into Hydrogen Electric Racing Federation, but.
Yeah. That's right, the racing series that you wanted to start.
Yeah, I mean,
let the race engineer solve all the problems.
But I mean, you know,
let the racers do it. Storage, delivery, heat. You know.
Well, there's, I don't know, one thing that I think everybody's ignoring when they talk about, you know, electrics catching on ultimately, or maybe fuel cells catching on ultimately, is I still think this natural gas thing is going to have a huge impact. And, you know, as we've talked about before, commercial vehicles going that route. And if commercial vehicles go, I think it's only a matter of time before passenger vehicles follow suit, if it really all works, if the fueling costs are truly that cheap. And that's just going to push all the other alternatives farther down into the century.
But, you know, you got to realize, though, that, you know, as we talk about commercial vehicles and their fueling needs, I mean, they're far more deterministic than any of us are in terms of our driving habits. And so they're pretty well, you know, known what their routes will be and where they'll be going and when they're going to be going there. And it's timed very, very carefully. I mean, I'm sure when the FedEx guy who shows up here, like the guy who shows up at our offices, I mean, he's on the clock. You know, he knows that he's got to be down the street in short order. Versus, you know, us saying, well, you know, I think I'll drive here, but no, I'll go over there, and so it's very random. But if we have a very set schedule, then it's very easy to you know, refuel your natural gas vehicle or recharge your battery for your electric vehicle or what have you. But you know, as long as we have this notion of we're going where we want to go when we want to go there, you know, it makes it more difficult.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, that's America.
It is.
Just get in your car and go somewhere.
Right. That,
well, and it, not just here. I mean, that's anywhere in the world. That's the beauty of the automobile. Just get in and go. You know, you don't want to wait around for 8 hours.
I think still more in this country than anywhere.
Oh, yeah, here. Oh, yeah, because here we don't have any public transportation unless you're in some of the big cities.
Yeah.
But you were talking about your hydrogen racing series. You were just at Indy, right, for qualifying?
Well, I mean, Indy, we have the fastest race in Indy history. We have a very popular winner in Tony Kanaan. I mean, it was pretty spectacular. The race itself was probably one of the best Indy races ever run.
I would say the last 3 or 4 years running, they've been
in terms of competitiveness and
it's a sprint. It's not like, you know, we'll cruise around for three quarters of the race and then get on it and see who wins.
And then, you know, the beauty of it is there isn't a green-white checker finish in IndyCars. Yeah. In NASCAR, there is. Well, we can't end the race on a yellow, so we'll run 3 more laps. Indy, it's 500 miles. It's not 506 or 508 or, you know, 511. It's 500 miles. And, you know, some people reacted negatively to that, but I think most people said, yeah, okay, that's what it should be. It's a 500-mile race.
Right.
That's it. Well, did we want, you know, 6 cars fighting for the race win? Yeah, but that's the way it ended. The coolest race at Indy was the Indy Lights race.
Why so?
There were four. It was a four-car abreast finish at the finish line.
Wow.
And a guy who was trailing the other three cars came up in the right, and they left him room right up against the wall and won by literally this much. Spectacular race. It's on, I mean, you can find it on YouTube. We have a link to it on Auto Extremist in our race, the line, the race, one of the racing things, and it's unbelievable.
So with Tony Kanaan winning the big race, as it were, did it surprise you that it was a veteran? I mean, isn't he, like...
He's 38.
Him and Frank Keady, maybe the two older,
yeah,
the
oldest.
Dario just turned 40. Tony's 38. It was his 11th race. Very popular with fans.
I couldn't believe it. You could hear the roar of the crowd on television.
That's
the
coolest,
roar of the crowd.
That's the coolest thing about Indy. I was stunned when I first experienced it. When the crowd drowns out the engines, it's unbelievable. It's just beyond, because the engines are just, I mean, it's this big cavernous thing, but the crowd actually drowns out the engines. And there was a huge roar when Kanaan won.
But to, you know, Gary's point on the age of it, you know, the longer the race, the more experience counts for it. The shorter the race, the more adrenaline counts for it.
And, I mean, experience comes in that race because the track temperature changes, the conditions change, the car changes. You got to tune in the car. The NASCAR guys do the same thing, and girls. But, you know, over that 500 miles at the speedway, there are all kinds of things that happen, and you have to be able to be right there.
You know, it surprised me, one thing about Indy is what, there are four women who are in the starting grid, and did you know that? I mean...
Yeah, I knew, because I follow it.
But I mean, but if you did, I mean, and, I mean, so these people get, like, no run compared to Danica NASCAR?
Number one, Danica is American, so the American media always covers American drivers far more than foreign drivers. Number two, she's a babe. I mean, she looks great.
American.
And that always works for everybody. And number three, remember, was it her rookie year? She was in the lead of the race. And so, I mean, that was electric when Danica, I mean, here's this girl leading the race. Oh, my God. And she never went on to really do much, you know, as exciting after that, even though she did win a race.
She won a race in Japan.
But that was sort of a fuel economy run. You know, it wasn't just flat out won the race. Nonetheless, you can't take the win away from her. But you put all that together, and... So now you've got four women in Indy, one of whom is pretty good.
Simona DiSilvestro.
She's pretty good. But the others are largely invisible. And I think, you know, it sort of just don't have the, you know, the charisma, the on-camera presence that a Danica had. That's how I read it, at least.
What about you, Peter?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, really, unless they get frontline rides and run well, they're not going to get much attention. Now, Simona runs well, especially in the road courses. You know, she'll run in the top 10.
But for the American media to notice that she even exists, she's going to have to win a race.
Exactly. Danica is very shrewd at marketing her personal brand. Maybe the most shrewd.
Well, and shrewd in tying up with GoDaddy.com, which featured her in so many of their commercials, too.
Yeah, and on the Super Bowl, no less.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah.
She's been on the Super Bowl more than any other actor or actress.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, so those guys had a race that on Sunday as well.
Yeah, this is just ridiculous. I mean, the arrogance of Brian France on NASCAR to think that the 600-mile NASCAR race belongs on the same day as the Indianapolis 500.
Even though it's been that way for decades.
Well, yeah, but, you know, now is the time to really make some moves. Move that race to Saturday night. And if you want drivers to go back and forth, America desperately needs some, you know, they need to pump up racing overall. Move that race to Saturday night. Run it Saturday night. And if a driver is qualified for the 500... And they get in their jets and they fly up to the speedway for Sunday. But it's just ridiculous. And frankly, 600 miles at Charlotte, really? I mean, it's worse than an NBA game. You watch the start and you come back for the last 25 laps. I mean, it's, the rest of it's just like, you know, just shoot me. You know, it's just.
Unless the camera falls down off of.
Yeah, that was, you know.
That was amazing.
That was a scary accident for anybody who didn't see that. They have camera cables or cables across the track so they can zip cameras up and down, which is really great. It does give some good shots, but one of the cables broke.
It's never happened before. I mean, it wasn't NASCAR's fault. It was a freak thing, but,
right.
You know. It didn't help.
It damaged some cars and it hurt some people in the grandstand. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's why we're even talking about it.
But, you know, for the big picture of motorsports, with the stick and ball media in this country, you know, stick and ball oriented media, it's all, if it doesn't have a ball or a stick, you know, the media is just like, So they're aware of two races. They're aware of the Daytona 500 and the Indianapolis 500.
And that's it.
So
it's as high as they can count.
Yeah, so, you know, move the 600-miler to Saturday night. They run it at night anyway.
Yeah.
I don't get it. What's the point?
And it would make it easier for drivers to compete in both races.
Yeah, there won't be a lot of them, but there might be two or three. I mean, Kurt Busch just tested an IndyCar in practice this year.
Brad Keselowski, who runs for Penske, says he would love to do it.
Yeah, and so it would be good for everyone in racing, but...
And Tony Stewart used to do it.
Yeah.
Run
both races.
Robbie Gordon, I think, was another one.
John Andretti.
Yeah, he would. Yeah, there were some people that would do it. I mean, Danica ran any cars. Maybe she, you know.
Yeah, that would be kind of
cool.
Sure,
somebody would give her a jet. I mean, it would be fine.
Right. Hey, why don't we take a quick commercial break here, and we'll get our guest, Jeff Owen, to come on the show. So, Ben, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. Well, Jeff Owens, welcome to Out of Line After Hours.
Thanks for having us.
So just so everybody knows, you're the chief technology officer and a vice president in Delphi.
Right.
And, you know, I'm sure a lot of our viewers are familiar with Delphi, which was once the biggest car supplier in the world, went through bankruptcy. And I'm sure there's a lot of questions about, you know, what's Delphi's commitment to the auto industry right now? But you run a huge R&D operation. Run us through some of those numbers, because I don't think people are aware of just how technology immersed Delphi is.
Sure. Well, Delphi is a $16 billion automotive components company, global, around the world. We invest a ton in R&D, in the innovation pipeline, $1.6 billion every year. And again, it's distributed around the world. It's across our product lines, but a significant investment, to be sure.
And did I read right? Something like 18,000 engineers?
18,000 engineers, 7,000 in the U.S., 6,000 in Europe, about 5,000 in Asia Pacific. So again, in the language and the culture and the market of our customers.
So this 10% investment that you guys are doing, I mean, is this something that is ongoing? I mean,
yes.
A commitment to?
Yes. And I should say it's 1.6 billion gross. It's 1.2 billion net. So it's a little over 7% net. That's what will show up on our P&L. The difference being what our customers fund or governments fund around the world. But 1.6 billion worth of spend. And that's the rate we've been spending at, even through the downturn. Hmm. We spent at that rate. We're blessed to have a CEO that's very technology focused, very savvy and supportive. He knows you have to keep the innovation pipeline full. If you take your foot off that pedal, it's very tough to get it back, get the credibility back with customers.
But $1.6 billion and 18,000 engineers, that's bigger than a lot of car companies have.
Well, fair point. But the products that we're in, the problems that we solve for our customers around the world take technology. And it takes leading-edge technology, whether it's emissions regulations or fuel economy regulation that creates problems that have to be solved for our customers, or the connectivity side of the house. For example, the infotainment, entertainment side, where consumers are demanding. The safety side, the safety equation, which gets more and more complex with more connectivity being brought in and a conflict with the driver distraction. So it's technology-rich product lines of what we focused on as we went through chapter. That's what we emerged with, and it takes an investment to keep that robust.
So what are the primary buckets that you put your investment into? How do you break that down?
Yeah, great question. we focused about 10 years ago on the megatrends of safe, green, and connected as being trends that we thought at that time and for a long time, and it's been true, will impact the automotive market around the world. Developed country, developing. So green, the emission standards, the fuel economy, depends on what problem you're trying to solve on the continent. It takes a ton of technology in the powertrain, even before you get to electric vehicles or hybrid vehicles, and that takes another complement. Safety being an area that always sells. It's always something that governments want to mandate and ensure a higher degree of safety, and it's something that consumers want to purchase. And then the infotainment side, the connectivity side, connecting the consumer with their life outside the vehicle while they're in the vehicle, but doing it in a way that is less distracting instead of more distracting. That's the challenge.
Go ahead.
Do you work with every car manufacturer?
We sell something to everybody around the world, yes.
Is there anything that our viewers or listeners could, that you could say, yeah, we do that in your car that they could relate to, or is this just Delphi, we supply the world?
Well, sure. I mean, we could talk for a long time about our product lines. We're in gas and diesel in the green business, so if you've got a gasoline direct injection system, or a diesel a common rail system, particularly in Europe, there's a good chance you're driving a Delphi product. A lot of infotainment, reconfigurable displays in the cockpit, a lot of the human-machine interface, again, around the world. The wiring harnesses, the connector beneath the skin, the thing that the consumers are very rarely aware of. We're in one out of every four cars around the world on that. I mean, we've got a decent market share in all of our product lines. Some products are visible to consumers, some are completely invisible. You trust that they'll work every time you turn the key on. If you get to your destination safely, a lot of time it's due to Delphi technology.
So of everything that you just described, what's the hottest? You know, what are car companies coming to Delphi and saying, Jeff, ooh, we need this?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's really all that space. In the green equation, the regulation just continues to get more stringent, more demanding. In Europe, it's emissions. In the United States, it's miles per gallon. In China, it's a little bit of both. They're really starting to move now to pollution control, but the regulations are similar everywhere, and we converge on a common set of solutions. So higher performance gasoline internal combustion engines we think will be around for a long, long time. They're just going to continue to get better and better. Gasoline direct injection, variable cam phasing, cylinder deactivation, just a myriad of things that will give you 3 to 5% bumps in capability. Diesel side, again, it's a very, very highly selected in Europe, but it's also, we think China will be the biggest diesel market on the planet.
Commercial?
Commercial. Medium and heavy duty, not light duty.
They don't seem to like it for passenger cars, do they?
They like gas in passenger cars. They like gas in passenger cars. But for medium and heavy duty, gas and that's going to be a significant market for diesel, we think.
So to the point of the various components you're talking about, gasoline direct injection, so what is it that Delphi is specifically providing to a system like that? I mean, the injectors or
the injectors, or the pump, the fuel rail, the pressure rails to get there, the electronics, of course. In some case, the cam phaser or the cam sensors, or the pressure sensors that also become part of the system. Mm-hmm. So
mechanisms, electronics, and sort of mechatronics combination of the two.
Yeah, the hard part of gasoline direct injection, because it's the first time that we've gone to a pressurized system for gas. We've always had it for diesel. Now we're entering into it in the gas equation, and you have the ability to put a couple of bursts of fuel into the cylinder to get a better dispersion of fuel, get better performance, less emissions. But it takes pressure to do that. It takes highly refined, highly machined injectors, just like the diesel market now, for gasoline to be able to do that. And you've got to generate 250 bar of pressure to be able to get those quick bursts. We do that as well as anybody in the market, but the thing that we do better than anybody in the market is we have a quieter system. We won the PACE Award 2 years ago for that quiet injector. With a diesel, you've got a Prindle that hits this orifice, you know, multiple times per cylinder movement, per cylinder combustion cycle. And if we slow down that Prindle right before it hits with software, just like an elevator kind of decels as you move down. You've been in elevators where you don't even know you've landed. That's what our Prindle does when it hits the end of the ejector. So it makes less noise overall, and customers really appreciate that. That's been one of the major selection criteria for Delphi.
So otherwise, you'd hear that.
You hear the click.
And right. Like,
to the point where gasoline direct injections almost sound like a diesel.
It's starting to sound like a diesel, yeah. Now, the pressure is quite a bit different in diesel. You were 2,000 bar typically on a common rail diesel and moving up from there. So gasoline direct injection is 250. So it's got some ways to go. But just to get that pressure, you start to get that clicking noise. With diesel, it gets to be potentially a lot worse.
Question then, are you guys on the direct injection gas V8 in the new Chevy Silverado?
That is our technology. It
okay.
is.
Because the only reason I'm glad that you are, because then it won't be embarrassing. That's the quietest direct injection engine I've ever heard.
Thank you.
In a pickup truck.
Thank you. Yeah, that's our technology. We're on the Hyundai Genesis, which is kind of their flagship for a premium vehicle. Again, because of the quiet, it was the major selection criteria for them as well. So it is a big selling feature.
I got another question going back to diesel for a second then. Next year, Europe goes to Euro 6 diesel emission standards,
right,
which is pretty close to the U.S. Tier 2 Bin 5. Will we really see a lot more scale in diesel emissions technology that will bring down the price in the U.S.? If the U.S. and Europe are using the same stuff,
yeah, you'll see some. But you also have to remember that to take this next step is going to take incremental cost upwards in the first place. So you're going to get more volume scale, but you've got to step up to achieve that in the European theater. So there's still a decent on cost there. At the price differential for fuel in Europe, it becomes still a pretty easy equation over there. In the United States, you don't have that differential. The consumers.
I thought that differential had largely disappeared in Europe, especially like in Germany, that the price of diesel is almost the same as gasoline now.
It's closer than it was, but there's still a spread. And, of course, then you've got the fuel economy plus with the diesel side to help do the math. But at $3.50 a gallon in the U.S., it's going to be a tough sell.
Is Delphi going to ever get back into sponsoring racing?
You know, that's a great question. I heard you guys talking about racing. We have been a sponsor in the past,
yeah,
and both of some of the race activities and of vehicles. It used to be for us, race on Sunday, you know, sell on Monday was absolutely true. We provided a lot of the first telemetry at the track, a lot of the engine controls, some of the safety equipment. But we found now it's a great proving environment, but the requirements from automotive manufacturers have gone beyond the racing world for the products that we're in. So we would do it for branding, and we'll make that choice at some point, but we no longer use it as kind of a product prove-out opportunity.
So what became the tipping point? What changed that automotive, you know, run of production became more demanding than specialized racing? Was there a certain technology or?
You know, when you start asking vehicles to last 5 years, 7 years, 100,000 miles, that's as tough as the racing environment or tougher. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the day, for the kind of design and validation sequences that we put our products through.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting thing, doing some of the research, you know, before you coming on the show here, and your people had sent me some stuff, too. You recently, and we're talking safety now, testified in front of the U.S. Senate. And very interestingly, the NCAP standards, the new car assessment program, where they smash a car in every single direction
right.
you can imagine possible. You said that's all very good, and there's five stars, and there's so many cars that have five fives right now, as
right.
they say. But you were saying NCAP really should have some sort of rating for active safety, not just passive safety, you know, how well the car crushes or whatnot, but you're saying how well it can avoid an accident
right.
in the first place. Walk us through a little bit of that, because I hadn't heard anybody say that before.
Yeah, that was a great opportunity. We were honored to be part of that Commerce Committee testimony. But at the end of the day, from our view, the benefits of passive safety have more or less plateaued in the United States and Europe. And 33,000 fatalities last year on the rate per driven mile, it's been pretty flat for several years here. we've protected the occupants about as much as you can. So our premise is, and I think the industry's at this point, is the only good accident is the one you prevent, right? That'll be the next big step to bringing it down. Simply said, most accidents are caused by driver error or driver inattention, about 90%, according to the NHTSA statistics. So active safety is a way to make sure, whether it's because you're distracted or sleepy or whatever the problem is, active safety can never, you can set it, you'll never be distracted, even if the driver is. So cell phones didn't invent driver distraction, right? I mean, we had a lot of opportunities for driver distraction before. That just adds to the problem. If you can make sure that the car is always in the game, even if the driver is slightly out of the game, 60% of accidents can be mitigated with just a half-second advance notice. So, okay, that's great. The technology's been on the road for several years. Many car makers are now putting it in where it will go to active braking instead of just adaptive cruise control. But consumers don't know what this does, right? I mean, they're not aware of how this works. We know safety sells. You make it part of the NCAP rating. They become aware of the opportunity, and they'll start to select it once they understand the cost benefit of that, just like they did with airbags.
So what would some of the things be that a customer could see that his or her car conceivably could have? I mean, what would the functions be?
What we would suggest for NCAP, and there's different variants of this, would be collision imminent braking and lane departure warning. Well, either one of those or both of those together have a significant impact on accident statistics, a significant impact on fatalities. It would be true in here in the United States and Europe. Europe is already making it part of the NCAP.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Do they add another star, or what do they do?
Well, they say starting in 2014, to get 5 stars, you have to have some kind of active safety technology. And they've got a list that would fit the standard. I think the United States should do it. It's a way, without policy, without regulating, you let the markets work. But you make the consumers aware of it, and they can make their own choice. And the past would show that the consumers will make very smart choices. And as they did with airbags, side airbags, curtain airbags were drawn in by the 5-star, the NCAP, well before they were legislated. Mm. I think we have an opportunity to do that here as well.
Mm. Any reaction from NHTSA to this idea?
They like the idea. After sitting through the Commerce testimony, it's clear government works slow, right?
I mean, and noticed, eh?
Yeah, well, it was painful, really. But that's the environment. You have to make sure that the data supports the theorem. You have to make sure that there are multiple suppliers and OEs that are ready to do this and do this in a robust way. I mean, that's absolutely understood. But I think the time has come. I think they are aware of that. We have a great relationship with NHTSA in terms of being able to show them some of the technology, get them on ride and drive, show them what's possible. We always like to say, Delphi's pretty good at this, because we are, but we also point out for them that X, Y, and Z is also pretty good at this. This is something that would benefit the whole industry. It would something that would have great socioeconomic benefit to the United States. It's time to raise your hand and say, follow me.
So would this fundamentally mean that there would be an increase in the number of sensors, whether radar, sonar,
yes,
LIDAR, what have you,
yep,
and processors brought into the vehicles?
Yes.
And, you know, there's always the concern, and I'm sure you know it far better than the three of us combined and multiplied, that, you know, there's a real keen focus on cost.
Sure.
And presumably by having some of this additional technology, there would be quite a ramp up on the
yes,
sticker.
Not as much as you'd think, but yes, you're absolutely right. They were talking about content and features that don't exist today, so there's an on-cost, and you know, every OE on the planet, particularly in the U.S. market, is reluctant to add to the price of the vehicle.
So
there's an on-cost, and, you know, every OE on the...
Hey, Ben, we're getting audio out here.
But that being said, the cost curve on the technology has come down significantly over the past 10 years. We're like in our 8th generation of product. And I mean, it's to the point that OEs like Ford, for example, are literally going across the board with the product offering on an option basis.
Mm-hmm.
But from the Focus to the Lincoln, they're offering this because the price has come down to the point where it's ready to democratize.
Mm-hmm.
It's still an on-cost, but so were airbags, and the consumer selected that ahead of the government requiring them being on. I think the same thing will happen
mm-hmm.
here.
So this is just, it's not an invention cost. You guys have already gotten the technology
right.
developed. It's basically just the cost of the product itself.
Right. Product, and you've got to provide the user interface, which anytime you're in the user interface space, the OE wants to have their fingers on the personality of how that's presented, how you interact, which is understandable.
Mm-hmm.
But the hard part is seeing what's there and seeing it at a rate of closure in time that you can give the driver some warning or activate the brakes in time to prevent or mitigate the accident.
Mm-hmm.
The easier part is how you interface with the consumer.
Jeff, you talked about connectivity earlier, too, and I'm holding in my hands right now this plug-in device that goes into the OBD2 sensor in a car. And I've got a smartphone here, too, as well. So this OBD plug-in taps into all the cars, and it allows individuals to do all kinds of diagnostics and other things with their cars. Not car mechanics.
Right.
You know, regular, everyday people. Walk us through this product a little bit, and why did Delphi focus in on this? What made you think that enough consumers out there would want to buy something to tap into their vehicle, their car's computers?
I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. We're really excited about the vehicle diagnostics by Delphi here. It's offered initially through Verizon, through the Verizon distribution channels, and the reaction's been pretty incredible by the people that have tried it so far. But you plug the module into the OBD2 connector port. It's the same port that's in every vehicle sold in the United States in the last 16 years. So it's a way to bring a car made in the last 16 years up to date with the latest telematics kinds of capabilities. So vehicle diagnostics, it'll give you the state of health of what's going on in your vehicle, give you an alert and nice, simple English language for the error codes. If you would happen to get one of those, you can replicate what your key fob does with the device. So you go to the portal, the Delphi portal, and you create a private account, a secure account. You get car to cloud, cloud to car, and wherever you are, any place in the world, if you've got your smartphone, you can replicate anything that your key fob does. So lock it, unlock it. You can do a remote start if that's what your key fob has. You can honk the horn if you want to do that. Again, not from the key fob range, but literally anywhere there's a cellular signal.
We've loaded this all in. Ben Sanders here tried it all on his car. So I'm looking at the phone right now. It tells me it's got a fuel gauge, tells me how much gas is in the tank, whether the battery's fully charged or not, any other kind of alerts that are coming in. Shows me with a little map, too, like a little Google map, exactly where the car is parked. Hmm. And then you can get other things like the health of your car.
Right.
If there's any diagnostic issues or, check engine lights or whatnot coming on. But I'm still very interested. How did you stumble onto the fact that regular consumers, not just mechanics, might want this kind of stuff?
Well, there's a lot of education to be done about what's going on behind the skin of a car. And most consumers really don't care as long as everything works. But when they get an error code, they want to know. When you put your kids in a car, you want to know that things are ready to go. You put your wife in a car, your elderly parents in a vehicle, you want to know that the car's up to snuff, that there aren't any issues. The other cool thing that it does is if you say you have it in an elderly parent's car or your teenager's car, you know where they are. You know where the location is. You can geofence. So if they go outside of a certain area or go into a certain area, it can send you a text or send you an email immediately. No BS, you know what's going on, right?
Mm-hmm.
That gives you a sense of comfort. Even if you're just making sure people get home on time or get home safely, it'll give you that kind of alert.
Life was better back then.
Yeah.
So that remains plugged in, and it's constantly communicating?
It will communicate at regular intervals, but if one of the triggers is hit, like a geofence is hit, or if you can set it anytime it's driven over 70 miles an hour, you can get a text message.
Mm-hmm.
I can set it if my wife gets close to Somerset Mall. I'll get a text.
A warning.
Yeah. Warning, yeah. Add some more money to the credit card.
But, I mean, with John looking at Ben's state of vehicle right now, so is it passive until he activates it through the phone, sends out a call to it and says, hey, what's going on? Or is it constantly broadcasting?
It's constantly broadcasting. There'll be periodic packet bursts, simple information. It'll actually go over a 2G network. You don't even need a 3G network. There's a cellular module in the product, so it's interfacing with cellular network. to send the information. So mm-hmm. yeah, it's your if you bring the screen up, it should already be updated for your current situation. Mm. It's constant. If you're driving the car, it'll show that your car is running, for example. So you know when the car is running.
So if somebody's rolling in a 1999 Neon or something, I mean, this is going to
1999 Neon. Anything in the last 16 years?
Yeah. Anything yep. with an OBD2. Sensor is going to...
Theoretically, anything sold in the United States by law in the last 16 years had to have an OBD2 connector. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty wild. You mentioned it's sold at Verizon stores, right. the phone company. What do they charge for it?
We're charging $249.95 for a two-year service package. That gives you the hardware and that gives you the connectivity access for 2 years free. Then they also charge $5 a month access. And of course, Verizon's looking for different products other than phones that would feed off of their network. It'd be another revenue opportunity for them. Been a great partner. We've got an exclusive period with them for a short period of time, and then you'll see other carriers offer them both in the United States and in Europe.
Has Delphi ever really marketed its products to consumers in the past?
Yeah, not really, John. I mean,
this is all new for you guys.
This is new, but it's in the spirit of telematics. I mean, we're big in telematics. We're big in the key fob and security systems. We know everything about what goes on in the serial data bus, you know, behind the skin. We know how to access the information. We know how to do it securely. We just thought it was a great opportunity, as we've shown other products around, particularly with smartphones in play, what you can do with your smartphone in terms of activating your car with your key fob from anywhere. A lot of people are attracted to that.
Well, I think it's sort of interesting if you think about it. I mean, that sort of capability you generally find on high-end vehicles now.
Right.
And so for most people who can't afford to buy a high-end vehicle, they have the functionality that is there.
High-end telematics for the masses.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Hey, we've got a lot of questions coming in from the audience
yeah.
right now. I think we ought to get to the rapid fire segment of the show. Ben, let's let her rip.
Look at this.
Hey, the first question I'm actually going to throw to you, Peter. Brian wants to know, with the Detroit Grand Prix this weekend, we talked all about Indy. We didn't even talk about the race here this weekend. Will we have a repeat of last year's track where it was all breaking up and they had to even stop the race and repave part of the track? Or are you confident Roger Penske has made sure it will not happen again?
No, I'm confident Roger has his troops in place, deployed. They've gone over that track, and he's spent something like $1.5 million of his own money. There will be no issues.
Really? He put his own money into
the
track?
I think so.
Man. Wow.
They're probably out there right now with little cans of epoxy just filling in everything.
Yeah, no, I think it'll be good. But they are run. It's a two-race weekend.
This is all new for Indy.
And they have Grand Am, and they have World Challenge. But I think it'll be fine.
I'll bet it is, too. Okay, Jeff, Rum and Coke wants to know. He says, until we get to truly autonomous cars, isn't all this increase in in-car infotainment devices merely going to cause carnage on the roads?
Yeah, I mean, the issue is driver distraction, and more driver distraction with cell phones and texting, and then smartphones and all that come with smartphones. We think there's a great opportunity with active safety if you put those together. We have a product space we call MiFi, but we think you solve that problem or mitigate that problem by working active safety and infotainment at the same time. So you can't make all that information available all the time. I mean, but in low workload kind of environments, if you have a way to know where the driver is in the game and have technology that helps pull them back into the game, you're able to, with voice, with maybe gesture control, technology that helps the driver keep their hands on the wheel, eyes on the road, mind on the mission. We think you can live in both worlds, and you can live in both worlds more safely than we're doing it today.
Yeah, I would agree. Hey, as an aside, you mentioned lane departure warning. What do you make of this latest research from the IIHS, the Insurance Institute, that suggests lane departure warning and blind spot detection, they can't find any evidence that it improves safety on the road, which just seems so counterintuitive
right.
to me. But that's what they're claiming.
Yeah, I don't understand the statistics yet in terms of how they're looking at it. We know for sure with accidentology, NHTSA statistics, that 40% of fatalities are somebody leaving their lane. right, and doing something bad. So it would seem to be counterintuitive. We all know personally with blind spot opportunity, everybody's done a lane change, and oops, there's somebody there. And the blind spot...
That's when gesture control comes in, too.
Yeah, not that gesture. Yeah. But we know that that blind spot detection has a great reaction from consumers the first time that it's used where that's avoided. I mean, it has a great pickup. How it applies to accident statistics...
I want to learn more about it. Here's a great one, especially for Peter, but please join in on this too, Gary. Joseph N. says, David Welch, our good friend here, wrote an article yesterday saying Sergio Marchione is about ready to buy out Chrysler, and the plan means the Agnelli family will no longer be the Fiat majority shareholder. And he goes on to ask, what's the strategy for Fiat Chrysler? What do you guys make of this?
Sergio has his plan, and he can't do anything that he wants as long as he owes that money. I don't know what it means for the Agnelli family long term. I mean, their influence has been diminishing, but still, I don't have any idea.
Wasn't it? He was just going to go to the market. He was going to borrow
$10 billion,
but and then he was going to buy the 41% of Chrysler he doesn't own.
Correct.
And then he'd get another deal to pay back that at a lower rate.
They were going to refinance all their debt.
So basically, the Agnelli family would own.
He's just trying
to still have stock ownership or whatever.
He has to cut the UAW out of the deal. That's what he has to do. So.
Yeah, but he can't. That's the VEBA trust, which is all the UAW people will tell you that's not even UAW. Of course, they represent the union, but I've met some of the people on that VEBA trust, and they are smart people. Let me tell you, this isn't a bunch of factory workers, you know, trying to work high finance. These are high finance people who know exactly what they're doing. So he's not going to get it on the cheap. I'm positive of that. Here's a great question, Jeff. And I've had other people ask me this in the past, and I've never been able to answer it. But you're the technology guy. So Kip on Trucking says, a battery works with two dissimilar metals in an acid. Why not just drain the acid and replace it with ionized acid? Why don't they do it like that?
It's called battery life, right? I mean, you accelerate the process, and you lose battery life. You lose the longevity.
So you'd destroy the battery over time if you did that. But it might work a few times.
Yeah, sure.
Very interesting. Now I know, and I'm glad you're on the show because I feel so much smarter now.
Do you guys get involved in battery technology?
No. No, I mean, we're in battery pack management for hybrid vehicles and electric vehicles. We've got a lot of expertise there, but we are not in batteries. And this has been a good time not to be in batteries.
Jerry Hightower wants to know, what's the difference between a shooting brake and a station wagon?
It's whether you're in Cheyenne, Wyoming, or Norwich, England. That's the difference.
That's the difference, right. They're the same, Jerry. They really are. A shooting brake just sounds more upscale, at least to our American ears, than a station wagon. Chuck Grenchy wants to know, what efforts can be done to reduce the technology lag between new electronic features and integration into autos due to the requirements for production lead times?
Yeah, that is the $64,000 question, and particularly as electronics cycles faster and faster, is how do you have anything approaching up-to-date electronics when you start 3 years before production and a car is in production for 6 or 7 years? It's really tough. At some point, you're out of date, and you're usually out of date before you ever hit car one. The challenge is to try to estimate, you know, the sight lines of when that technology is going to be ready and automotive grade, because that's not trivial, to get it automotive grade and have as up-to-date a profile as you can going in, and then have the opportunity for refresh, if that's possible. As more and more products are delivered in software instead of hardware, that does open up the opportunity to do some more refreshes mid-cycle or, you know, even on a pay-per-view kind of thing. But it's going to require, as all of the electronics tier ones around the world work with the OEs, that you try to get into configurations going forward where you can update the processing capability and update the, you know, some of the software that goes behind. You have reconfigurable displays, for example. Those are easy to think about updating, but it's not easy if the processing relies on the next highest speed processor and you don't have it in the car. You've got a display, you're all dressed up and no place to go. So you've got to find a way to architect that you can replace some of the core processing kind of capabilities, and then you've got an update plan that can work for a couple of cycles.
Is it possible to develop an electronic system that's basically agnostic and that would be predicated on, you know, Peter's phone is different than John's phone, which is different than your phone, but the car recognizes it and then utilizes its capability rather than, you know, automakers all trying to chase having the latest and greatest when, yep. you know, when you know that, you know, somebody's going to go to the phone store tomorrow and buy a new
right.
phone, and they're not going to go to the car store tomorrow and buy a new car.
Right. Look, there's no doubt about it. The most sophisticated piece of electronics you own today is your car, right? I mean, we're well past that threshold. But when you bring your phone in the car, that's the single biggest complexity that you're bringing in. I mean, it's really sophisticated processing, but it is not automotive grade. So you can design architectures that way. We're actually working on a few right now where you take advantage of the phone's capability to extend or leverage what else is going on in the car. So navigation, for example, get it from the cloud, get it from a 3G network, and then you don't have to have the onboard cost of having a nav engine that will go out of date at some point. But now you're trusting that the car-to-cloud connection and cloud-to-car is going to be robust. You're trusting that your phone is going to be reliable and you're not going to leave it on the dash on a hot day. You're trusting that you're not going to have to pick this up and mess with it, right, and cause more driver distraction. So mm-hmm. we want to make sure we're working in the right direction on that. So there's some good thoughts, and there's some programs underway with several OEs that I'm aware of that do just that and leverage that, but I do think that's an opportunity if it's done correctly. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I'll say, in some of the lower segment vehicles where you may not be able to afford some of the more sophisticated electronics. Anybody can buy an iPhone 5, mm-hmm. and if you can, or a Galaxy 4S,
sure.
and it doesn't matter if it's a Cadillac or a Fusion,
mm-hmm.
right?
So not everybody can afford an A8 and
right.
having the Google Earth and.
Right. Speaking of processors, ATG says computer chip technology is developing at a furious pace. Has Delphi made a choice of what industrial standard architecture it will support? And he goes on to ask, do automakers specify whether they want to use Intel's X36 or ARM ecosystem?
Yeah, great question. And they do specify, typically, and they're all different, unfortunately.
What a surprise.
Yeah, it's, you know, they all want to differentiate their vehicles and the experience, the user interface typically here with, and so they'll go to different architectures and they'll get on different acceleration rates on the digital curve. But it could be an Intel, it could be ARM, it could be NVIDIA, it could be, TI Jacinto 6. It's any number of products that are coming into play. We have to be agnostic to that. We have to be able to interface with the best of them and stay up to date with the best of them. It's a real challenge.
Gary, here's one I'm going to throw to you because I don't know the answer to this. This comes in via Twitter. It comes from @TeslaMotorsEV, who hastens to add, he's not the brand, he's just a fan of Tesla. And he says, will you discuss today's Tesla Motors supercharger announcement?
I'd rather discuss the fact that Cameron Diaz is hanging out with Elon Musk. That's probably more important.
More newsworthy.
Yes.
Well,
what was the supercharger?
So basically, if I have this right now there are a grand total of 8 supercharger stations, period, right? And so the plan is they have announced that they're going to be, I think it's tripling by the end of the summer, then tripling again by winter 2013, and by 2015, they will have 98% of the United States and Canada covered with superchargers such that a person could conceivably drive across the country. And I'm trying to remember, it's in term between now and 2015 that they're going to have the ability, if you go I-80, you'll be able to go across the country using the superchargers. And They are also, because these are, I think, 120 kilowatt chargers.
Sounds right.
Probably. No,
fast chargers. 30-minute chargers.
And they're down to, Elon said, 22 minutes. And they're going to be working to, you know, accelerate that as much as they can. And all this, and it's free. So you have your Model S, you drive across the country, and it would cost you zero for your fuel, as it were. So, you know, it's interesting if you think about this because, you know, again, if we go back to the beginning of the auto industry, you know, it'd almost be like there would be Chevrolet gas stations and there'd be Ford gas stations. And so, I mean, so basically the guy's, you know, developing the car and then he has to, oh, by the way, I have to build the gas station too and fit it up to my vehicle. So,
but if I had a Leaf or a Volt, could I go use one of those?
Apparently not.
Oh.
Not because I don't think the connector is
a different connector.
No, I'd be like, we're sorry.
Yeah, you should buy a Model S.
You should have bought a Tesla.
You
right.
See that Holiday Inn over there? There's a socket outside.
Yeah. You know, and it's very interesting that if you look at the Tesla website where they have there's a section that identifies where the superchargers are. And there's a little map. Maybe it's like you're looking on that phone there where you see the little map where the car's located. And I noticed this. I was just looking at one of the supercharging sites today. And, you know, they're making the argument that, okay, 20 minutes, you're going to have to kill time somehow, right? And so there's one that's like, there is a Starbucks that is close to the supercharger station, but you cannot see it from the supercharger, but it's, you know, it's around that corner. And it's just like, wow, these guys really have to go the extra mile to make their technology more appealing, I guess.
Yeah.
Another question for you here, Jeff. Eric Ambrose wants to know, how do lane departure and active braking work in winter when you sometimes run into snow on purpose?
Yeah, sure. Well, lane departure warning right now is usually configured to just give the driver alert if you're going outside of the lanes, whether it's an audible or a tactical kind of alert. So the question with snow is, can you still see the lane boundaries and continue to give that you know, high degree of security? And the answer is yes. With digital signal processing now, even a completely ice-covered road, you can still define lane boundaries with a high degree of accuracy.
Really?
Yes. And you can provide good feedback for the driver in virtually any kind of environment. Collision imminent braking, of course, you've got to understand the different coefficient of friction that would be going on there. That's nothing that the car system would do. It's easy to integrate the information that you have the possibility for ice or the information that your wipers are on, that you're on a wet road and you know what the temperature is. So you could consider that you could put that into the algorithm really straight on a straightforward basis, but the car OE would have to make that decision.
You know, I ran into an interesting situation this past winter driving an S-Class Mercedes where a warning came on the dash that said, all safety equipment not operable, or words to that effect.
Yes.
And what had happened is a bunch of slush had built up on the front of the grill. You know, that big Mercedes star is actually where all the electronics reside behind right now. Oh. And I literally had to pull over to the side of the road and wipe off with my hand all the slush, and then the warning was still on. I had to turn the engine off and restart the car, and then it recognized that it could see again. But there still are some winter issues with some of these technologies.
Sure. We like to think of the space behind the mirror as the optimum space to put the technology. And it's typical that radar's in the grill somewhere. The video camera's typically behind the rearview mirror. We're working on a product now. It goes into production next year called RayCam, where we take the processor, which is separate, the radar unit, which is separate, and the video camera, which is separate, put them all in one unit, put it up in the package protector area behind the rearview mirror, and then you minimize the weather concerns. You're still going to have weather concerns.
You're still behind the swipe of the wipers.
Right.
So that's going to keep the glass for that camera clean.
But if you start up and you had a frost or you had a snow accumulation, you'd have to deal with that. But the systems have to be able to tell you when they're not functional, right? Mm-hmm. So you know not to depend on them, and that's exactly what yours did. That was good.
Yeah, no, I liked running into that problem. I didn't like running into it, but I'm glad I experienced it, just to know all these different things
so
about.
You should
cars.
Experience very, very little, but if it isn't working, you need to know.
Okay, and last question here. I'm going to throw it out to both Gary and Peter here. AM2 wants to know, is there a future for a basic, lightweight car, not filled with too much tech and other weight-adding gadgets?
I would like to think so, but I don't see a manufacturer doing it anytime soon.
Thoughts, Gary?
Well, I mean, safety presumably adds a significant amount of cost just to...
Right.
So, you know, you can make it lightweight, but to make it safe, you probably have to add cost to it. So I think therein lies the problem. I mean, you know, Volkswagen's got the X1 coming. That's sure as hell lightweight. But
but
it won't be cheap.
$75,000 or something, and there's still money on everyone.
I mean, you're no longer going to be able to have the bare bones vehicle. I mean, those days.
Unless you're in a developing country and you just want
to. Nah. I'd point to the Tata Nano, which is an abject failure in India. A $2,500 car that nobody wants to be seen in because they just know all their neighbors and friends in the public are going to point and say, look, that's all they can afford, the cheapest car there is.
I'd rather walk than be seen in a Nano.
Right.
Yeah.
So it could become a slogan.
Yeah. Now, lightweight, go buy a Lotus. I mean, boy, those guys are the primo ones. Chip's giving me a signal here. We've got a phone call, right? Let's bring it in.
Hi, John. This is a question for Jeff. Could the Jeff's company go to the insurance companies and look for discounts or maybe even sell his unit through the insurance companies so that it could be an alarm system or a tracking system or something of that sort? And does Jeff's company also make GPS or custom information centers on the cars? Thank you.
Yeah, great questions. We do GPS or the navigation products for sure. That's a key part of our infotainment portfolio. Your question about the insurance institutes, we have a regular dialogue with them to keep them informed in terms of what the capabilities are and what we view as the cost trade-offs. Of course, they have their own view on that, but they are very supportive of the technology.
But I think what he's really getting at, right? Shouldn't you get a discount?
And the discounts are starting to come. If you drive a Volvo XC60 with CitySafe on it, 27% fewer collisions, and they get a hefty insurance discount.
Which can help pay for that technology.
Which can help pay for the technology. Volvo in Europe is one of the leaders in safety, and they've got our latest safety portfolio on there. They have collision imminent braking, and they brake on pedestrians over there. I mean, with the technology, which is another leap of faith that the technology is robust. But over there, you typically buy an insurance policy when you buy your car. 3-year policy, they'll give you 1 year free if you have the active safety on it. That's a significant motivator.
Savings. You bet it.
Those are going to come. So I think that's a great question. So the best we can do is keep them informed in terms of what the capabilities are and what the trade-offs are. They are very supportive of this. I'm very confident that discounts will come. Aftermarket for us is really a tough option in the safety environment because it has to be validated at the vehicle level to be able to access those discounts, I think. I think you would miss a lot of the robustness of the implementation if you didn't have the vehicle validation of the OEs. They're so good at this. I think we got to go through that phase first.
But couldn't there be an aftermarket product that, even though it didn't do the automatic braking, gave you warnings?
Yes.
And I would think that would be relatively easy to retrofit.
Yeah, that is where it will start on the aftermarket, is to give you warnings and, you know, have a way configured to provide the warning in the cockpit. But, yeah, that would be...
Because like you say, if you get an additional half-second warning, it can make a difference.
It absolutely does. So, yeah, that's a strong possibility.
Very interesting.
Great question.
Yeah, really good question. Well, let's wrap it up here. But Jeff Owen, thanks so much for coming on the show. Yeah. Very interesting stuff. We'll have to have you back. I think we only scratched the surface of what Delphi's doing.
I love to talk about our technology.
Cool. Gary, great having you here, as always. Peter, always good to be with you. I want to remind everybody, we're doing this experiment tomorrow, what we're calling AutoLine Premium. We'll give you a behind-the-scenes look of how we shoot our television show. Check it out on our website. Check it out at autoline.tv. We're going to charge 99 cents. For you to be able to take a look at all this. And like I said, just an experiment. Anyway, thanks so much for having tuned in. We'll see you again here next week.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.